Today on The Brian Lehrer Show, some of our recent favorites, like science guy Bill Nye, on the now influential anti-science agenda, which he's trying to fight, and how we struggle to understand complex climate science and other complex scientific ideas that matter to our everyday lives. And we've got a series of conversations with more than one guest. Azar Nafisi, the author of Reading Lolita in Tehran, in conversation with the young adult author Jacqueline Woodson, who just won the 2014 National Book Award for her book, Brown Girl Dreaming. We'll hear the authors Andrew Solomon and Chris Beam together on non-traditional families, and the authors Isabel Wilkerson and Stephanie Kuntz discussing their books that both take the myths and false nostalgia out of 20th century history. And we have the basketball great and now poetic Knicks announcer, Walt Clyde Frazier, today. You know, he of the slicing and dicing and swishing and dishing. He'll join us with City Lore's Steve Zeitlin to talk about poetry and jazz and the way basketball has changed since the days he wore a Knicks uniform. But first, Alec Baldwin and Ira Glass together. A new season of Alec's WNYC podcast, Here's the Thing, is now underway. And his first guest, as you may have heard, was the host and creator of This American Life, and now the editorial advisor of the This American Life-produced hit podcast, Serial. You may have heard of it. They joined us to talk about the new season of Here's the Thing and Ira Glass's work. I started by telling Alec, Ira's a great pick for season premiere. How big an Ira fan are you?
We wanted to, you know, when we found the resources to start again and the funding and to do it again, and we had lapsed for like a year, I thought, who can we do that we can just completely suck up to the entire podcast community?
Especially the public radio podcast community.
Who's the Taylor Swift of podcasting? Get him out there. And everyone
Thank you
loves
very
him.
Much.
But by the way, obviously, with his busy schedule, we are eternally grateful that he took time to come and sit with us. It was great.
So, Ira, on your busy schedule, I heard you say in the podcast that you work so hard at your show and your outside appearances that you hardly consume any culture. Did you know that the guy who interviewed you was in something called 30 Rock?
Yes, I've seen a lot of 30 Rock. I think I've seen most of the 30
Rock. He watches it when he's walking his dog.
Yes.
Exactly.
But I don't know. After listening to the podcast, Alec, I think we need to get Ira out more, don't you?
If it's going to hurt either This American Life or Serial, I would prefer he stay sealed up hermetically and just working. I don't want him. Well, he's really not missing anything culturally. Just let him keep doing the show.
Good answer. And Alec, since I played the theme to your podcast and identified the theme, I'll ask you one that I've been curious about, because I know that Miles Davis song, So What? And I wonder if you chose it because of the title as a secret little message to people who know it. Something about your attitude. Oh, so what?
I'll take credit for that with the public radio audience if it'll help me. But I guess back in the days when actually Miles Davis music was introduced to me. I mean, I knew who Miles Davis was, but I didn't really listen to his music that much until I saw the Dustin Hoffman movie Lenny.
Uh-huh, about Lenny
and
Bruce.
In the soundtrack of the movie Lenny, there's quite a bit of Miles Davis music. It Never Entered My Mind was the song we wanted to be the theme for our show.
Also not a good theme for an interviewer.
Well, I mean, if you think that there's some hidden meaning, It Never Entered My Mind is actually more appropriate, because whenever I listen to the show afterward, you know, they'll send me a cut, and whenever I listen to the show afterward, all I think about is the missed opportunities.
Do you know I walk out of the studio every day thinking exactly that thought?
Oh, Brian, I'm not just saying this. I mean, your show I listen to every morning, and you know, when I'm not shooting, and your show is just such a great resource. I mean, you have people on. I don't know how you could have any doubts, because you always ask, well, I think, that are the good questions and the questions that lead to some kind of some examination of a course of action with these policies and so forth. And to interview Ira, it was like, I mean, I hadn't, the only problem with interviewing Ira was I hadn't done it in a while, so I'm kind of warming up now, doing it again, and figuring out the rhythms of when to shut up and when do you step on people and when do you kind of turn the conversation back toward whatever. And when you talk to Ira, it's tough. He's tough to keep up with.
Ira, do you have the luxury of a produced show. So when you walk out of an interview and go, damn, I should have asked blah, 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 like I do every day, you can go back and do it again or edit it so it looks like you addressed the question, right? Is that
exactly
a luxury?
Right. Yeah. Yeah, it's such a luxury. Yeah, yeah. I did live radio for a little while. I hosted Talk of the Nation for 6 months, and I am not suited to it at all because a lot of the moments in interviews that I like the most are, you know, you're going down a long, digressive road, not sure if it's going to lead to anything. And then because we're doing, you know, a documentary show, yeah, we totally will call people back. Like, if there's another question or another point that we feel like, oh, we should have asked that. I should have asked that too.
Brian Lehrer with Ira Glass and Alec Baldwin to help kick off the new season of Alec's WNYC podcast. Here's the thing. But Alec, a minute ago you mentioned Serial. Didn't come up in your conversation. I don't know when you recorded it, but have you been listening to this new This American Life?
I just started listening to that.
Mega
yeah,
hit. Mega hit.
No, I really enjoyed it. I mean, I've become quite a podcast listener because I don't really have a lot of time to watch TV, and so when I'm working now I have downtime, you know, like I'm shooting a film right now in Pittsburgh, and where you have little windows of time, podcasts are good, you know. I'm enjoying that a lot, and I think Serial is a really great program.
So let me take a minute and just say to the listeners who haven't heard it yet that Ira, you've done it again, you naughty genius. For listeners who don't know, Serial is a weekly podcast hosted by reporter Sarah Koenig as a This American Life spinoff that is reassessing the murder of a high school girl in 1999, allegedly by her ex-boyfriend who is serving a life sentence, but who might actually be innocent. And that's the question. Did he do it? Did the criminal justice system work in this case? It's like a giant game of Clue in a way. Did you have any idea that this would take the podcast universe by this much storm?
No, none of us had any idea. I wish I could say that we were smart enough to be able to know something like that.
What is it about it that you think that they like?
I mean, I think that actually the thing that's new, which is the serialized form, the fact that instead of every episode being its own story, like with Serial, every episode, for those of you who haven't heard it, basically each episode just brings you the next chapter of the story, and so it's designed. We thought, like, maybe we could give people the kind of experience they get on a Netflix series or, you know, like a great HBO series where you just want to come back to get the next, what happens next. We thought, well, what if you tried to do that with a podcast with a true story? And I think that it's a combination of that format and the fact that it is a murder. And then just, I have to say, like, I think 90% of it is just the sheer skill that Sarah Koenig is bringing to it. The fact that she's such a great reporter, you totally trust that she knows what she's talking about, but she herself is having reactions to the material.
I can't believe you've actually borrowed from television shows like Dynasty the idea of the cliffhanger.
That's true. Who shot Haley?
There's a lot to learn.
I can't believe you borrowed from Joan Collins.
Danny, in Lambertville, New Jersey, you're on WNYC with Alec and Ira. Hello.
Hi. Thanks a lot for taking this call. Let me just say before, Brian, I really enjoy your show, and your political stuff tends to make me cry at least once a week. So there's that.
Thank you, sir.
This is actually for Alec, and I was wondering, like, and I heard him just now talk about how he doesn't have a lot of time to watch TV, and he tends to listen to the podcast. I was wondering if he tends to have a fondness for radio, or has he always had a fondness for radio, and was that part of the reason why he chose to do the movie The Shadow?
Well, I mean, when I was a kid, it's funny, we used to listen to this show. We used to, maybe Brian will remember the show, the old Dick Summer show.
Wow, I did listen to Dick Summer.
Dick Summer had a game he used to play on the air called Mouth versus Ear. And it was a quiz game, and it was not necessarily trivia, but it kind of resembled that, where he was in a studio with some sidekicks of his, and they would ask you all these word games and things. And I used to listen to that when I was a kid, and I remember I watched TV when I was very young, but I kind of turned it off when I got to be like in high school, because it really kind of, when I was a kid, it was like The Addams Family and F Troop, and then I moved over to like Love Boat and Fantasy Island, and I kind of abandoned network TV then, and I listened to a lot of radio, and but I think that The Shadow, when we did that film, I think it was really just Universal wanting to jump on what they thought was a kind of a comic book bandwagon, and the movie didn't really turn out very well, and it didn't really perform very well. And I think that there's a reason for that. I think that the whole thing was really just geared toward radio, and making it as a film wasn't the best idea.
John in Bergen County on WNYC. Hi, John.
Brian, good morning.
Your question is for Ira, right?
Yes, it's for Ira. Ira, I think you'd be a great producer for 60 Minutes. Having said that, have you been approached by them? And if you were, would you consider going to 60 Minutes as a producer?
I can't see you at 60 Minutes, but maybe you could be.
I take that as flattery. That seems like a really that's a really nice thing to say, because I feel like the 60 Minutes, like This American Life, they really know how to tell. I feel like they really know how to craft a story as a narrative. I feel like they make long form narrative television, and I feel like when I see 60 Minutes, I feel like, oh, I understand what that is and how they do it.
It's just almost the opposite narrative style. Part of what you were talking about with Alec on the podcast. The old announcery style, as opposed to you just coming on as regular guy Ira and talking to people like people talk to people.
No, that's true. It's very old school the way they do it. It's very, very, it's not the modern way of getting authority by being yourself. It's the old way of being authority by being kind of a deep voice, narrator. But that said, like, the storytelling is great. The storytelling is super skillful. And that's why they're number one. I feel like that's why they do so well. Sorry, Alec.
No, I was going to say, when we talked about that on the show, when you talked about people with that fake gravitas and the Simpsons type of TV announcer, do you think that people who've gone against that, and as you said, have spoken more like regular people, that some of that of them have achieved a style, which is the anti-authoritarian style, which is just as much of a cliche and a style in itself itself? I mean, I don't want to name names, but there's a couple of people on public radio I listen to all the time where I go, my God, if they push this any further, you might as well be putting ether on a cloth and putting it over my face and putting me to sleep. You know what I mean? They just got such a kind of lulled tone to them, and they just have taken all the edges off. But do you feel that some people in public radio that are more contemporary, they've gone too far the opposite way in terms of their delivery?
I haven't heard anybody who bothers me that way, but I can, you know what I mean? Like, I don't go that far, but I think like once somebody's working a style and it stops being their actual personality, when you get into fakeness. That's just bad performance. It's like bad theater on the radio
I hear some of that sometimes.
Another reason that the 60 Minutes question is intriguing to me is that I think This American Life has gotten more serious and issue-oriented in recent years. Maybe it was more individuals, quirky stories before, and you seem to have taken a serious turn, Ira. Do my ears deceive me?
No. That was a conscious decision on the part of the staff. I mean, at the beginning after September 11th, I think the whole country got more interested in the news and us as well, and I think any show is better when you're just following your actual interests. And so we've done a ton of stuff on the war on terror, on the financial markets, on climate change, on just like any possible, on politics. Like, I feel like we run at it, and the idea is that we run at it in the same style that we do the more personal stories. So when we take on any subject, we look for, people and conflict and emotion and funny moments and a real story that'll unfold.
We are talking with Alec Baldwin, host of the WNYC podcast Here's the Thing, which is kicking off its new season with guest Ira Glass, who is now our guest too.
Hey, Brian, can I say a word about what I like about Here's the Thing, why I was a fan
from
the beginning?
Yeah.
I feel like Alex is a really interesting interviewer to listen to and really different from other people. And he's interviewing, famous artists and also political people and people, occasional economists or figures like that. But he's interviewing the kind of people who Terry Gross would have on. But it's so radically different from a Terry Gross interview because Alec just talks way more and is just really fun to listen to. No, I feel like it's just a very different experience. And Alec, you're just as famous as many of the guests, and just things happen in the interviews that I find so interesting to listen to, and I don't know. And then there are these, like, I just, you know, when you interviewed, and so many of the people are your peers too. Like, that when you interviewed Letterman, there's a moment at the end where, like, Letterman, who doesn't seem like somebody who would be, like, super open to lots of interviews, says in this way, like, he's sad that the interview's over. He's like, wait, are we done? Like, this is it? Like, we gotta go? And like, and in that interview, I remember he just tells you just straight up, like, no, I don't work that hard anymore. Like, I used to work really hard making the TV show.
The kind of show he used to do, and now it's different. But when you mentioned before the guy was talking about 60 Minutes, you know, both of you know infinitely more than I do because you've been doing radio longer. At the moment you put a camera on someone, everything changes. And when I had this short-lived program I did for MSNBC where I tried to do the long-form interview, like the podcast for television, everything changes at the moment. Most people, not all people, but most of them are in front of a camera. Radio is radio, obviously, and I just think it's completely different. Our program, if you will, our method is to get into the room with someone and do long form. And after 15 or 20 minutes, you're not pushing them and manipulating them to tell you something. They tell you what they want to tell you in their own time, if you give them time.
In fact, it was interesting, like, going to the studio where you record it, too, because I feel like I've been in TV studios and been interviewed, and it's always a kind of a big impersonal space. And the studio you record is an apartment. It's a guy's apartment where he has a studio. Larry Josephson, this old famous radio guy, has and then that studio itself, like, radio is an intimate medium to hear, right? Like, over the air, it's like, it's so intimate and personal, and like, that's the amazing thing about it as a medium. But then, like, just being interviewed by you, first of all, like, you're kind of a big expressive guy, and we're in this tiny little room in a guy's apartment.
It's a closet.
Yeah, basically you're in like a closet, and so the space itself has this intimacy where you feel like, and then in any conversation, if the other person is emoting as a human being, you're a robot if you don't emote back, and then Alec is like emoting the hell out of everything as he's talking to you, and you're in this tiny space with them, and so you can't help but open up.
We tried to cut out a lot of my emoting, by the way. We did our best to cut it out, but
I think that's good technique. Then the interviewee just, like, is just seems to be emoting a lot.
But when you did Billy Joel, you, like, sat down at the piano and played and sang with it. Terry Gross would never do that.
Well, the other thing that you both know is that we have a wish list of people. I mean, in a fantasy, we have a whole patchwork of different kinds of people that we want to talk to. Like today, we're saying we want to do Madonna, David Blaine, an expert on police shootings and criminal prosecutions of police shootings. You know, but we just go all over the place and say this type of person, this one from this field, and this author and this playwright. But the reality becomes, you know, who's available, who's in town, because we don't travel anywhere. And the very first pilots we did a pilot package of a couple of shows, maybe five shows, rather. And we interviewed, you know, one example was we interviewed Alan Simpson because we wanted to have a Republican, you know, a conservative Republican voice
Senator from Wyoming.
In the bin. And we did it by phone, and it was terrible. You know, we realized they've got to be live in the studio with us. We don't want to do it over the phone for our purposes. And, you know, who's in New York and who we do is always an issue. I think I did two interviews in L.A. and one I did at the Super Bowl with Andrew Luck, the quarterback. But everybody else we've done in New York.
Chaim in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hello, Chaim.
Hey, good morning. It is such a pleasure to be on the radio with three of the people that bring me such enjoyment. You really, what you guys put through the radio is just phenomenal, and it really is a pleasure to listen to everything that you guys are producing, all three of you.
Thank you.
The question is really for any of you, but really it's to Ira. You know, I've been following Serial, which I love. I've even gotten my wife to listen to it. Not an easy candidate to listen to anything having with murders, but I try to explain to her it's more the psychology. You guys did a great job with it. But the question is, you know, it's such a line to walk, and I wanted to hear how you handle entertainment that is so pertinent to people's lives, that changes, you know, people's perspectives, the way people view situations, and at the same time, someone's life on the line. How do you walk that line of ethics and responsibility for truth, and at the same time making sure that it's enjoyable and pleasurable and entertaining? Is it a conundrum, and how do you deal with it?
I mean, I don't want to speak for Sarah and Julie, who are putting together Serial, but it's not that different than the way we do the stories on This American Life, or the way that lots of reporters do stories. You know, and we're trying to make something that has a pace, you know, that's paced so you can listen to it and that raises questions at the beginning so you want to keep listening in just the normal way. You want to make something interesting to hear. And then you know, we're trying to be respectful to the people in the story and make them appear as they really are, you know, and try to get across just how complicated things really are. And I feel like you can feel how Sarah has gone out of her way to make these people not cartoon versions of, you know, certain kinds of high school students, but they seem like real people. You get to know them well enough. And I feel like that's how, I don't know, like that, I think that you can treat people fairly in a way that although you're telling a story in a way that you want it to be engaging for the audience, like you also want it to be so thoroughly three-dimensional that it's respectful to the people in the story, and you just keep your eye on that balance.
And you know,
and
what
I
only,
that's what they're trying to do.
I only pulled one soundbite to embellish our conversation with today, and it's the one that Sarah Koenig calls her favorite answer in all the interviews that she did for Serial, which you probably know what it is, Ira. It goes to the very heart of what you just said about spinning the complexity, the 3D nature of this incredible story. So she's interviewing somebody involved who says,
"Well, then who the f*** did it? Why would, it doesn't make sense. I'm probably just as confused as you are."
You'd never hear that on All Things Considered, Ira.
I don't know. Maybe not.
But the caller raises a question. This came up, the caller's question came up when we did a special recently about the controversial John Adams opera, The Death of Klinghoffer. And regardless of whether people think it's too pro-terrorist, which is sort of the shallow New York Post-level firestorm, regardless of that, Adams made an opera about a private family, the Klinghoffers, who just went on a little vacation cruise and got caught up not only in the actual murder of Leon, but then the global media phenomenon for decades after, to this day, this opera about themselves that they never asked for and don't like their dead relatives' portrayal in. And I wonder about the ethics of that a little bit with Serial, too. I'm sure many families, including high school kids at the time, who wish their little role as witnesses or tangential bystanders or not in this 15-year-old murder that they didn't commit, would just go away. Has that been an issue for you and Sarah?
Yes. I mean, people's privacy especially, like, has been an issue from the start, and we've tried to protect people's privacy as much as possible. And there are certain people who Sarah doesn't say their last names ever on the air. We've never published a photo of Hay on our website. It's been interesting in the coverage
victim.
To see, the young woman who died. We've tried to be as respectful about the fact that these are private people who didn't ask to get pulled onto the radio, as we can.
Bob in Rego Park, you're on WNYC. Hello, Bob.
Hey, Brian. Alec, I wanted to ask you, you know, I think you are so fantastic. You're intuitive, creative. Your comments are mind-boggling in terms of psychology. Do you feel as though you're being misinterpreted by the public, by the newspapers, the reports? And also, do you read the Bhagavad Gita since your wife is a yoga teacher?
I'm open for anything these days. If the Bhagavad Gita has even one answer, I'll take it. But no, I think that what you learn, my favorite quote was in the American Masters program about Woody Allen. And they did the show about Woody, and they asked him what he thought about, you know, what he'd been through. And he said that he had the greatest answer. He said everybody's entitled to think whatever they want to think. He said, if you read something about me and you believe that about me and that show alters your opinion about me and it leverages you to not want to ever see a movie I make again, he said, I understand that. He said, you're totally perfectly entitled to do that. And I thought, God, I just couldn't believe how, for lack of a better way of putting it, how zenned out Woody was when he said that. But you know, the things that people say in the press and what's reported in the press and what people believe and what they don't believe, that's something that you learn is beyond your control. You know, the only complaint I have is that there's no correction page on the Internet. But other than that, it's as they say in The Godfather, it's the life we have chosen.
So you think a lot of those things that were reported about you were inaccurately told. Like, you know, honestly, I'm sure we've got some listeners who are big fans of yours out there right now who might also be thinking in the back of their mind, you know, Alec Baldwin, he's a great actor, he's a funny guy, cool podcast host, and I like his politics, but he keeps having, well, these incidents that sort of make me cringe. You're saying, don't believe what
you
read?
Well, I think the only one that I'm in the middle of a mediation with MSNBC because of the termination of my contract that involves a lot of the discussion of what you're talking about. But, you know, there was one story that took place where this guy claimed I called him a racist epithet, this black photographer. And I wound up going down to the police department, and they wanted to investigate it for as a hate crime. And I sat in the Manhattan DA's office with a staff of people, and they proceeded to go through this whole thing. And I said, well, the guy was a videographer with a camera. I said, do you have a tape of what happened? And there was kind of a hesitation on their part because they were hoping that if I had said something to this guy, I would have admitted it in spite of the tape. So there was this pause, and they kind of reluctantly said, well, yes, there is a tape. I said, well, let's play the tape. Let's play the audio portion of the tape that accompanies the entire time I'm with this guy. And you don't hear me say any of the things that he claimed that I said. And I said, are you going to prosecute me for hate crime? And they said, no. The Post didn't report that. The Post said, this man called this former police officer a racist slur. And when the Manhattan DA's office said, that's not true, the Post didn't say, that's not, you know, print the review. So in the Internet now, we only have the accusation, and we don't have the follow-up. And that incident, by the way, was the one that I was the most hurt by, because I thought to myself, I never considered myself someone who was racist in that regard.
All right. Somebody needs to invent corrections.com. Or I don't know. That's probably
What you realize is that's never going to happen.
Yeah.
And the other thing you realize is that you, in this age we live in now, speaking for myself, I have to live differently. I mean, I just do not live, since the things that have happened to me in the last year, I do not live my life the same way anymore. I just don't. There's things I don't do. There's places I don't go. There's situations I avoid in the extreme. Ira says, you know, you talk about protecting your privacy. How do you protect some degree of privacy while you work in this business? It's becoming increasingly difficult to do.
So, yeah. Ira Glass, nice start. Who's coming out? Who else is coming up this season on Here's the Thing? Got any names, Alec?
The ones we have in the can now are Gay Talese, the novelist Gay Talese. We have Julie Andrews, Sarah Jessica Parker, Julianne Moore. We have three famous show business women in a row. And then... we let off with Ira Glass, who I'm eternally grateful to. And thank you. Thank you both, actually, for doing this with me. Thank you.
Ira Glass, Serial, This American Life, Alec Baldwin, the new season of the WNYC podcast, Here's the Thing, getting going. So what?
So what?
Thanks, you guys. That was fun.
Thank you both.
Coming up, Azar Nafisi, the author of Reading Lolita in Tehran, in conversation with the winner of the 2014 National Book Award, Jacqueline Woodson. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we continue now with our series, Books That Changed Your Mind. We're doing this in conjunction with the New York City Neighborhood Library Awards. The nomination process is over, and the nominations are under review. If your library wins, it will get a $20,000 prize, so it can buy more books and other things to continue to educate, entertain, empower, and change people's minds, as libraries do. Today, I'm pleased to be joined by two great writers, Azar Nafisi, the author of Reading Lolita in Tehran, and her newest book, The Republic of Imagination, America in Three Books, and by Jacqueline Woodson, the author of many books for children and teens, including the book for which she just won a National Book Award, Brown Girl Dreaming, a memoir in free verse. Jacqueline Woodson writes mainly novels for young readers, and Professor Nafisi writes about reading and teaching novels to college students, first in Iran and now here in the United States at Johns Hopkins. So in this conversation, we'll focus on novels that change young minds. Welcome back, Azar Nafisi. Hi.
Hi. It's great to be back.
And Jacqueline Woodson, welcome, and congratulations on your National Book Award.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
And books that change minds. I don't know if you two have ever met or ever read each other's books. You write in different areas. But I think you both very much believe that novels can be as effective as nonfiction in changing minds. Azar, would you put it that way?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. I think the whole idea of novel is based on multivocality of voices, on the writer getting under the skin of every individual, even the villain. So the novel by itself has such a democratic structure that just the experiencing of reading a great novel changes your mind and opens your heart.
Jacqueline?
I completely agree. I think that as a writer of fiction, you have to exist in so many different worlds. And by existing in those worlds, you allow your reader to do the same thing and have multiple perspectives.
Jacqueline, I saw you quoted saying that when readers care about your characters, quote, they'll do whatever they can to kind of protect them and hold on to them and change the world for them, and that novels give young people the courage to create change. Can you give me an example of how your fiction has connected to real life like that?
Well, the example that comes to mind first, of course, is If You Come Softly, which was a retelling of Romeo and Juliet and the story of a African-American boy and a white Jewish girl who fall in love. And, of course, the tragedy is someone has to die, and the person who dies is Jeremiah, the 15-year-old African-American boy. In a case of mistaken identity, he's shot by police. And it was published in 1994, and at that time, there was somewhat of a gap between, say, the murders of Edmund Perry and Amadou Diallo, so people weren't quite in that space of believing. And since that novel, since that time, I've gotten so many letters from young people and so many letters from adults saying, my ideas about this have changed so dramatically because of how much I love this book and love Jeremiah.
Mm. And Professor Nafisi, is it generally that seeing the world through someone else's eyes that makes fiction mind-changing?
Definitely. And that is why, you know, I can't understand the discussions that come up mainly from our elite and political elite today, saying that books or novels are irrelevant to the reality of our lives. Because I think the telling of the story has been with us since the dawn of mankind, and since the Greek mythologies, Bible, Torah, Quran, they all use stories in order to tell the experiences that we feel and to discover the unknown that we need to discover in order to survive. So I think that every great novel, every great story is the story of that unknown. It gives us the possibility to look at the world through the alternative eye of the other. And the most important thing, as Alice in Wonderland discovered, it questions not just the world, but you. You remember the caterpillar when Alice asks him, who are you? He throws the question back to Alice, saying, who are you? So those intimate strangers and alternative eyes also question you and make you redefine yourselves and your values.
You should see Jacqueline, writer of children's books, smiling here. What do you want to say?
I just so completely agree with you in the fact that as a reader, you're a different person from between the time you open the book and the time you close it.
Is that why you risked teaching Lolita in Tehran, Azara, to cite the title of your first book?
Well, yes, that was why I wrote Teaching Lolita in Tehran. And by the way, Jacqueline and I didn't meet in Miami Book Fair, but we just came from here, and I'm dying to congratulate her.
Thanks.
You so deserve to win this prize. Without the prize, you have already won the prize. But going back to reading Lolita in Tehran, you know, it just broke my heart the way people in this country were indoctrinated to think think of people in Iran and in that part of the world as complete strangers, as aliens, represented only by the Iranian regime and not by the people. And I wanted to show them that how when ordinary people like myself and my students were deprived of direct contact and access to the world, what we turned to was not politics, but what we turned to was the great and golden ambassadors of other cultures. So we turned to Melville and Zora Neale Hurston and Saul Bellow and Toni Morrison, the great filmmakers, the great artists, the great musicians. And I wanted to remind them that this is the gift that immigrants bring to this country, to remind you not to take these freedoms for granted.
Dimitri in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello. Dimitri, you there?
Hello. Yes, I'm here.
Hi, go ahead.
Hi, yes. So I'm from Belarus, and originally where I was a professional ballroom dancer representing my country. And then I read the first book in English was John Grisham, The Firm, which inspired me to come to New York and actually to get my MBA in the United States.
Cool. Did it work out?
It did. I did. I moved to the United States 5 years ago, and I completed my MBA in Boston 2 years ago.
What was it about The Firm? Was it the streets are paved with gold in the United States, or something, you know, more conceptual than that?
It just was the culture that I didn't quite understood. I was reading the book, trying to grasp what is it to be professional. I've read he was a lawyer. To me, it was inspiring to be a professional other than being a dancer and artist. And so business was attractive for me. So I decided to go for MBA rather than law degree.
Dimitri, thank you very much. And Azar, you may not be interested in the same things, but there's another immigrant story.
That is the whole point. You know, nowadays immigrants are at the center of our attention. And one thing that I wanted to remind America, and especially the American elite, is that this country is based on the alternative eyes of those others who come to this country and constantly remind us that the American dream is not just material wealth and prosperity. It is having an idea, having a dream, and being given the opportunity to actualize that dream. It might not fill your pockets as much, but it will definitely, definitely open your heart.
Peter on Staten Island, you're on WNYC. Hi, Peter.
Hi, good morning. In 1960s, I was a police officer in New York City, mm-hmm. and during the Watts riots, I wondered, why would they riot in Watts? I saw pictures of Watts. There were no projects. There were wide streets. There were palm trees going up and down the avenues. And about 30 years later, I read Walter Mosley. And Walter wrote about Watts and the people living there. And it completely changed my entire perspective of why the people in Watts rioted. They were completely oppressed. And I never knew that in the 60s. I always wondered, how could you riot in a beautiful neighborhood from Brooklyn all the way to the Pacific Ocean? And then I read him, and I understood completely.
But it wasn't a sociology book. Was this a murder mystery, a detective
story?
This
was Walter Mosley, yeah. One of his, The Girl in the Red Dress or something.
Yeah. Yeah, Jacqueline, Walter Mosley reader?
I love Walter Mosley. I love Devil in a Blue Dress. And I think it's a really interesting point. Dr. Rudine Sims Bishop, who was a professor of children's literature for a long time out of OSU, talked about the need for both mirrors and windows in literature, that children need mirrors, reflections of themselves on the pages, but people also need windows into other worlds. And I think that's what the caller is talking about, that window into the world of Watts that he didn't understand until he met Walter's story.
I love that, mirrors and windows. And sometimes people don't like the windows that you provide, because your books are often on, I guess, what are called challenged lists, because they feature characters and situations some parents and teachers don't want their kids to know about?
Yes, and it's so interesting because, of course, all you have to do is challenge a book to get a kid to read it. So I'm all for challenging and bringing attention to the story.
Put me on the National Book Award list and the challenge list, please, says Jacqueline Woodson. And Professor Nafisi, a character from a book that changed minds long ago is part of the focus of your new, The Republic of Imagination. Why Huck Finn in 2014?
Well, talking of challenged and banned books,
absolutely.
This book has the honor, and I think Americans should be very proud of the fact that this book that represents what it means to be an American in many ways, both Huck and Jim and others do that, has had the honor of being challenged and banned from its birth to the present. And that shows how relevant books are to our lives. Otherwise, if books were not relevant to us, why would we challenge them? And of course, another way of challenging books is indifference, not reading them. And that is what today worries me more than anything else.
Of course, Huck Finn is usually challenged, I think, for its use of the N-word. Maybe if people read it more carefully, they challenge it for similar reasons as Jacqueline's works, because Huck Finn is homeless and breaking laws out of conscience and a victim of child abuse. We've just got a minute left. Can I each get a book from you that has changed your mind, someone else's book, and maybe for you as a child reader? Jacqueline, you have one?
I actually have two. Reading Lolita in Tehran completely changed my mind about so many, and was a window for me. And also, of course, James Baldwin's Another Country.
And you don't have to throw it back at Jacqueline, you don't, and give her one of her own books.
Oh, my God. It is an honor, but the fact that we both share Baldwin, I will also give you two books very fast. One would be Baldwin's Go Tell It on the Mountain. I think he brought a new perspective. I mentioned in my book that it should be another great American novel and simply another great novel. And one of the progeny of Huck Finn is Baldwin. The other progeny is Raymond Chandler's The Long Goodbye.
We have to do a short goodbye here right now, I'm sorry to say. So thank you for putting those books out there. Thank you for putting yourselves out there. Jacqueline Woodson's Brown Girl Dreaming just won the National Book Award, as are Nafisi's new one is The Republic of Imagination, America in Three Books. Thank you both. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We'll continue after the news with Bill Nye, the Science Guy. Also, the authors Isabel Wilkerson and Stephanie Kuntz together on their books that take the false nostalgia out of 20th century history. And Andrew Solomon and Chris Beam together with more conversations about books that change their minds. And we have the great basketball player and Knicks commentator / poet, Walt Clyde Frazier. But first, the latest news live right now from the WNYC newsroom. It's a Best of Brian Lehrer show on tape today, so we won't be taking your calls. It's Brian Lehrer show on WNYC, and in February, as some of you have heard, Bill Nye, known to many of you as the Science Guy from his PBS show, traveled to Kentucky not to drink bourbon with Mitch McConnell, but for a debate at the Creation Museum. He was there for a one-on-one with a creationist around the question, is creation a viable model of origins? And by most assessments, he totally won. Since that debate, Nye has written a new book called Undeniable, Evolution and the Science of Creation, and How to See Evolution All Around Us. And we're very pleased to have Bill Nye in our studios today. Welcome back to WNYC.
It is so good to be here. Good morning, good morning.
And for a little background on you first, in addition to what people already know, viewers think of your bio beginning and ending as Bill Nye the Science Guy, but we learned that you worked on Boeing 747,
yes,
for example.
My beloved 747, yes. Don't worry, everybody. I was very well supervised.
And the debate in February was around the question, is creation a viable model of origins? Why that word? Why viable?
That's the word that the Answers in Genesis organization chose, and upon which we agreed. So, okay, I just think the word viable may be overused. My Latin teacher probably wouldn't like it very much, but it's it was good enough. The whole thing is we talked about creationism.
It's a softer word, I guess, than the only possible truth. So there was a moment in the debate that you write about in the book, and which many write-ups of the debate picked up on back in February. It's an example that you give about a tree in Sweden, which is over 9,000 years old. Would you tell us about that tree and why it came up?
Well, I'm not an expert on the tree, but people, the locals, call it Old Tjeko. I don't speak Swedish very well. And it's 9,500 years old. By some estimates, 9,550 years old. And you do that by counting rings. And it's been there longer than anybody can remember, and so on and so on. So to me, if you have a tree that's almost 10,000 years old, we didn't have a flood 4,000 years ago, for crying out loud. But this guy and his followers insist, or seem to believe, that it's somehow possible.
Well, wait, if there was a flood 4,000 years ago, why would it have destroyed every tree in Sweden?
Well, the whole world was flooded. The premise of the bit is that the entire earth was underwater for a year.
And your opponent's response was pretty much, well, nobody has watched that tree for 9,000 years. We cannot know what has happened in the past, meaning they don't even accept the science of counting rings on a tree.
That's right, exactly. Furthermore, he has created, pun intended, this sort of doublespeak description of natural history, where he has what he calls observational science, which we can see it and do it right now, and then historical science, which is whatever happened before you could see it. So, in other words, evidence doesn't matter. I mean, in other words, if you go into the room with the dead guy on the floor and the blood on the carpet, that you don't, there's no evidence there for this guy because nobody was there watching the guy get murdered, what have you.
So I want to play a clip, not from your debate, but from a spoof that you were part of on John Oliver's HBO show.
Well, that was big fun.
About climate change debates. So here's about 40 seconds from Last Week Tonight.
Good evening. Joining me tonight, a climate change denier and naturally Bill Nye Science Guy.
Humans are causing climate change, no question.
Wait. Before we begin, in the interest of mathematical balance, I'm going to bring out two people who agree with you, climate skeptic, and Bill Nye, I'm also going to bring out 96 other scientists. It's a little unwieldy, but this is the only way you can actually have a representative discussion. Please file in. Again, this is going to make the debate difficult. We shouldn't really be having it in the first place.
Ha. So John Oliver making a great point there that the one-on-one debate is not really representative when 96% of scientists agree on the basic conclusion.
It's 97 in this one case because I counted as one.
Oh, you were
96
one.
More.
Plus you.
Not to split 96s. But
there were two on the anyway.
No, there were three on the other side.
So
there was a guy sitting there, then they added two.
Right.
Then I'm sitting there and we added 96.
Right. So maybe it's 96 divided by three. But never mind that. Going into the Creation Museum debate, this is the relevant question that kind of harkens back to that clip on climate change. Some scientists thought you should never have agreed to a one-on-one debate, science versus creationism, on evolution because you legitimize the creationist point of view by engaging it as an equal in that kind of a debate. Did that give you pause?
Oh, yes. So the drawback, the potential catastrophe is by doing this sort of appearance, you raise it energizes his base, or the Answers in Genesis base, and they apparently have access to millions of dollars, apparently from generally people who made money in coal in the Kentucky area, and so that's really the downside. But the upside, I claim, is it draws a lot of attention to it. So where he may he could have been undone in many ways. By, we would hope, voters and taxpayers in coming elections in Kentucky. But a mistake that they made subsequent to the debate was there's a job application on their job applications on their website. And by the way, they hire all sorts of high-tech people to have to promote their Facebooks and their Twitters and their social media awareness of their indoctrination efforts. But on the job application, you had to have a testimony as to your belief in Christianity, and you also could not be homosexual. You could not be gay. And apparently you can do that if it's your own family, right, your Hobby Lobby thing. But you can't take tax dollars and do that. It's against the law. It's against the Constitution, if you will. And so they may they may get unraveled just from that. But my hope is that by raising awareness, you know, this doggone thing has had millions of views online. By raising awareness of it, we can point to the problem. And the problem is we will raise a generation of students, science students, in that area that have no understanding of or very limited understanding of science. And this is not good because young scientists, people who become engineers, are how they innovate. This is what keeps the U.S. economically in the game.
This is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River, New York and New Jersey Public Radio. Brian Lehrer with you with Bill Nye, yes, the science guy, whose new book is called Undeniable: Evolution and the Science of Creation. I'm so glad you used the word science in the title. Because everybody talks about the theory of evolution. That's the usual media shorthand and popular shorthand. And I don't like to say the theory of evolution. I like to say the science of evolution because it's a very complex science. How many evolutionary biologists have we had on the show over the years? And, you know, you can get into such meticulous detail, and the science is so fascinating. And there are uncertainties in the science because it's science. So the theory of evolution, it gets to me, it almost – puts as a, you know, as a media shorthand or a popular language shorthand, puts creationism on an equal footing. It's the science of evolution.
Well, and as I like to say, evolution was discovered. It wasn't something somebody made up. But Darwin used the word theory of evolution. He lived in the 19th century, and that's the way the word was used. And a scientific theory, just to clear the air, is something that makes predictions. You can predict what will happen. We can know what the apple crop will be like 5 years from now because of our understanding of genetics and evolution. So to say something is just a theory is in popular vernacular is like it's just an hypothesis. But it's not quite the same, and I know we go around and around about this, but evolution was discovered. It's a real thing. It's not something you can choose to believe in or not believe in. It is. It's the fundamental idea in all of life science. And as I say, my concern is not really for the grown-ups in Kentucky and or that the other places that are in denial or choose not to teach evolution, Tennessee, Kansas, Texas, those areas. The concern is for the kids, for the students, because we need them. We need them to innovate in the future.
Does acceptance of the science of evolution necessarily argue for a position of atheism?
Oh, that's up to you all. But no matter what you believe, no matter what your creation story is, the world is not 6,000 years old. So as I say, people get a lot of comfort, especially community, from their religions. They gather on weekends and they help each other out and they eat together, and I appreciate that very much. But the world's not 6,000 years old, and teaching that to children is in nobody's best interest.
In theory, a supernatural God could have snapped her fingers at the time of the Big Bang and started the entire process of evolution. And that's part of creation. That's not what the Bible says. That's not what the Creationism Museum says. But
that's sort of what the Pope alluded to the other day. You know, more power to him. As we say, you cannot know. You cannot know if there is a deity setting the clock, the watchmaker. And for many people, this is very troubling. There was a Big Bang. The evidence for the Big Bang is overwhelming. But what came before the Big Bang? Nobody knows. And that, to me, is compelling and wonderful and makes me get up in the morning. To other people, very troubling and want to check out.
This is WNYC FM HD and AM New York, WNJT FM 88.1 Trenton, WNJP 88.5 Sussex, WNJY 89.3 Netcong, and WNJO 90.3 Toms River. It's New York and New Jersey Public Radio. Mario in Manhattan. You're on WNYC with Bill Nye. Hi, Mario.
Yeah, hi. I was wondering if anybody speculated on what is the larger agenda for this creationism argument? Is it just a kind of general defense of religiosity, or is there a more insidious and implicit reason for this argument?
Well, that's a great question, and so the advice of legal counsel is for me to use the verb seem. He seems to believe this, and they seem to be very interested in everybody's well-being. And I've come to believe that they probably are. But they do raise millions of dollars, and they spend millions of dollars indoctrinating children. And as we say in science, as my old professor Carl Sagan remarked, when you're in love, you want to tell the world. So I come to accept that these people are very passionate about their beliefs, their fundamentalist Christian belief, with the extraordinary extension of that, where the Earth's only 6,000 years old. And so they want to indoctrinate as many people as possible into their worldview. But for me, their worldview is obviously wrong, and we've got to curtail it. We as voters and taxpayers have to curtail their efforts to indoctrinate children. You know, as the First Amendment will not prohibit the free exercise thereof when it comes to religion. But you don't get to use tax dollars in public schools to teach children pseudoscience, especially for me, where my vote counts as much as anyone's there. And we have these tremendous technical or societal problems to solve. We have Ebola. We have human immunodeficiency virus, and we have 7.2 billion trying to burn and breathe the atmosphere. We got problems to solve. We need scientifically literate students.
I think Jim in the Bronx wants to continue this conversation with you and your lawyers about what drives the anti-science movement. Jim, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My question is, again, what's behind the general denial of science that you see, not just in the facts of evolution, but climate change and so much else? Why are so many Americans now committed to denying science?
This is a great question. Jim, you're asking a great question. So in my book, did I mention my book?
Oh, look, there's a book here by Bill Nye called Undeniable, Evolution and the Science of Creation.
Anyway, I believe it's for most of us, it starts with our brains, which just end up to be, if I may, more than we need. So we outcompeted our ancestors, outcompeted other hominids like Neanderthals, Cro-Magnons, and we ended up with this ability to recognize patterns and especially to predict the future, which is of great value in hunting. It's great value in raising crops or at least finding food sources. And it's of great value in choosing a mate or finding a mate. And so along with that, we end up with this capacity to realize that we're going to die. And that is so troubling. Where it really got me, I got to tell you, was algebra. When I see people who, like, and I'm one of them, went to all this trouble to learn algebra and calculus and stuff, and then you die and all that goes away. Oh, it sucks. And so along with that, we all, I think, have trouble accepting that it all goes away when we die. Whether or not it does is yet to be proven, but it sure seems like it does. And so that leads us to create these complex stories about what happens to you after you die, and one thing leads to another, and then you just can't believe that humans can change the climate of a whole planet. And by the way, this is closely, very relevant, because Ken Ham and his Answers in Genesis ministry preach heavily that there's no such thing as human-caused climate change.
That's the person you debated.
Yeah, yeah. And there is, and we just can't have these people denying climate change when we have climate change so obvious to everybody else. You know, when you travel anywhere else in the world, everybody talks about climate change all the time. Everybody's concerned about it, except here.
But part of what you are suggesting with people with their big brains evolving—
Just big enough.
Or a little too big. Actually, did you ever read the Kurt Vonnegut novel Galapagos, which, of course, goes into Darwin and evolution. And right from the beginning of the book, Vonnegut is writing in his Vonnegutian way, the problem with humanity is that we develop brains that were too big.
That's it. Seems to be the problem.
Which led us to all kinds of problematic behaviors. But in this case, you're almost suggesting that the evolution of our brains has led a significant number of human beings to not believe in the evolution of our brains.
So there's a chapter in my book called Evolution is Why We Don't Believe in Evolution, which is exactly your point. So, Jim, I'm doing my best with this, but it seems to be a result or almost an artifact of having brains big enough to recognize all these patterns, to build New York City, to have subway systems that carry a billion riders a year, to feed everybody. Along with all that, we end up with the capacity to realize that it's all over when it's over, which is just – it just sucks, first to admit. Very troubling.
It scrambles our brains, and so many of our beliefs after that and behaviors are –
So we're in Manhattan, Brian, and it's big fun. Is there anybody out there who really believes in this creationist worldview and has called in and wants to talk it over? See, when you're near the coasts or you're near
easy.
A big river where there's a lot of commerce, people don't generally embrace these extraordinary views.
Oh, but this is the public square. Everybody listens to this station. So you want somebody like that? We got him. Jonathan in Lakewood. You're
Jonathan,
on WNYC. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, how are you? All right, so really, I got a lot of questions about evolution, but I'll start with one. My first most basic question is, how would you explain the evolution of human consciousness? I mean, you could explain how, like, a tree could evolve or, you know, beings could evolve to adapt to their surroundings, but how would a human consciousness, different than, like, the brain of a computer, ever evolve?
Well, here we are. So the question of where does consciousness come from, did I mention my book, is in the book a little bit, and it's a mystery. So for
well, an explanation.
But here's the thing. How does that – hang on a second.
Wait,
Jonathan,
you'll get back in.
Jonathan, just one moment. Let's say we cannot explain where human consciousness comes from. Let's say we cannot explain why certain complex computers need to sleep and they apparently dream. Let's say we cannot explain that. That does not make the Earth 6,000 years old. That does not make it so there was no Big Bang. That does not make it so that the speed of light is not the speed of light. It does not make it so that 8 completely unskilled people could build an ark and have every species, all 16 million, very conservative estimate, probably closer to 80 million species, come into existence in 4,000 years. Just because we can't explain human consciousness does not justify or enable or allow a critical thinker to establish the idea that the Earth was flooded for a year 4,000 years ago. Take it, Jonathan.
Okay. You just mixed together a few different points that don't necessarily go together. I was disputing the fact that you think that human beings and all living species came from some primordial soup or some amoeba which evolved into human beings with full consciousness. I have an explanation for consciousness. I think it comes from the spiritual side of things. And whether how old the world is a separate dispute. I happen to be, I'm not Christian, I'm Jewish. I happen to have maybe a different view on this. Judaism does have different views on this. There are Kabbalistic views that do perhaps go with this, that the 7 days of creation were alluded to and that God meant a second of 1,000 years. And it does fit exactly actually with the whatever, however many billions of years I never went through, because it's not that important to me how old the world is. My point is that I don't see how anyone could deny the spiritual side to the world if that's the only way to explain human consciousness. Consciousness is something that exists out of a physical realm. It's not a physical thing. You can't explain consciousness in physical terms. So I think that everybody, by the fact that they're consciousness, right, like the original philosophy, right, like I think, therefore I am, that the consciousness of a human being is itself the greatest proof of a spiritual side to the world.
So we don't agree, Jonathan, I mean, let's start with this thing Brian and I started talking about was the debate in Kentucky, which was about the age of the Earth. Okay. So you brought up consciousness and you asserted in several sentences there that consciousness is not a result of chemical processes in a brain.
Right.
I don't agree with you. It sure seems to be. And here's the evidence for, and listen, I would love it if it were. bring it on. If I were somehow some kind of special guy. But the evidence for this I present in – did I mention my book? Did I bring that up, Brian?
I don't think so.
Mentioned this. My beloved grandmother lived to be 96.
Okay.
As she got older and older, she lost her faculties. She lost her consciousness.
Okay.
So I'm open-minded, but does your consciousness, in your view – and this is a cool question. I'm right there, Jonathan. Want to talk it over. Does your consciousness slowly dribble out of your ears or something and you lose it? Or is it a result of chemical processes? And for further evidence of this, and I hope you buy a carton of my books and give them to your friends, and I know a guy who can autograph them. Anyway, why do other mammal species exhibit altruistic behavior, you know, help each other out behavior? Why are they tribal? Why do they exhibit the same sorts of behaviors that humans do? Why do we love dogs so much? If we don't have more in common with them than we are different. And so if you say dogs have consciousness, and they very well, they seem to, they dream, they carry on, then where do you draw the line? Squirrels?
Okay, can I answer that question?
Bring it on.
Okay, so if you would have done your research, I mean, I don't know the Christian side of things. I'm coming from the Jewish side of things. Based on Jewish belief, there are four levels of the human soul. Human consciousness is the highest form of consciousness, which is called, actually in the Bible, it's called that God himself breathed a spark of life into the human body. And the idea behind it is that just like God is able to create new things, human beings are able to come up with original ideas. Animals, as we've seen, have not progressed. There has been no progression in the animal world. Animals do the same that they've always been doing because animals cannot be original thinkers.
Well, we don't agree on the facts, Jonathan, so carry on. I don't know if you spend any time with chimpanzees, but... We don't agree on the facts.
Jonathan, one more minute, Jonathan. Then we're going to go on.
One more minute. Carry on. Get to the next three levels of consciousness. Take it.
20 seconds per level. I mean,
whatever. I'm not going to go through the other two because you asked about animals, but there's an animal soul, which the belief is that it's sort of the most physical level of soul, which every human being has in himself, the animal soul, which is the lower side of human beings, and then there's a higher level of soul, which is the godlike, which never dies. That's the side. And it's basically your choice because the two are fused together. The animal soul is the physical body. The two are fused together. And as the animal soul, the two are connected. So as the body dies, the human soul doesn't have a medium to come out in this world. And therefore, that's why as people get older and their body wastes away, you'll see their consciousness and their intelligence wastes away because they don't have a medium for their godlike soul to function in this world. It's because the animalistic side of them has died. And therefore, their soul is somewhat less connected, and that's why you won't see their soul coming out.
Jonathan, I'm going to leave it there because we are running out of time. Do you want to give him one more
response? No, we disagree on the facts. It's okay. Carry on.
And Jonathan, thank you for engaging. Before we run out of time, just two things real quick. In the book, you express disappointment with the scientific community to have allowed creationism to become so influential.
It's disappointed in myself as a science educator. To have allowed this. I mean, I'm not blaming everybody.
Who could have done what more?
If we are successful in lobbying the U.S. Congress, for example, to arrange for an education system, Department of Education, let's say, to have very qualified science teachers to teach evolution in school for the last 100 years, we wouldn't be facing this problem. And the models for this I give you is sort of Europe, Japan, Australia. And so I say this a little bit tongue-in-cheek. It's a long journey to change everything. But everybody, I know you've heard this many, many times. In order to have very highly qualified teachers, we have to pay them. There's no substitute for paying them. No substitute for teachers. So if you were able to get out of college and get a job that paid as well as a software engineer, as a high school biology teacher, it would change the world.
So speaking of changing the world, last question. Do you think your book will change anyone's mind, or is it sort of preaching to the choir, bad analogy, just by virtue of who's likely to buy it and read it?
I think the reason I wrote the book was to change the world. That's why I wrote the book. Whether or not I will... or it will, remains to be seen. And my editor, who's a great guy, Corey Powell, he's probably been on the show. He's a very well-known science writer who helped me distill down 120,000 words into 80-something thousand. He said he took the job working with me because I said to him at a meeting, I want to change the world. And so when it comes to changing your beliefs about creation stories, it's not something that happens in an hour or in one reading of a book. You got to be exposed to ideas, think it over. It takes most people years to change. If they're brought up in this extraordinary wrong worldview of the earth being 6,000 years old, it takes many, many exposures to the ideas and science, the discovery of evolution, before you come around to accept it. So, yes, I want to change the world.
You sound like somebody who should do a new PBS show.
That's been discussed at length. I would love to do that. I'm always in negotiations with another television show people. But in the meantime, we can, as I like to say, yes. Change the world. Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
Bill Nye the Science Guy.
Bill Nye.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up, two writers who changed how many of us see 20th century history. Isabel Wilkerson, author of The Warmth of Other Suns, and the author Stephanie Kuntz, who wrote The Way We Never Were, American Families and the Nostalgia Trap. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and we continue with our series, Books That Changed Your Mind. We're doing this in conjunction with the New York City Neighborhood Library Awards. Go to our website to see more information on the awards. I'm very pleased to be joined by two writers whose books changed the way a lot of us see 20th century American history. Isabel Wilkerson, the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter-turned-historian who wrote the amazing book The Warmth of Other Suns, the epic story of America's great migration. And Stephanie Kuntz, known for her collection of myth-busting history books, most prominently The Way We Never Were, American Families and the Nostalgia Trap, and A Strange Stirring, The Feminine Mystique and American Women at the Dawn of the 1960s. Welcome back, Isabel and Stephanie.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
Books That Changed Minds. I'm curious if that's what you set out to do, Stephanie Kuntz, or if that's just where your research led you.
Well, I think it's where my research led me. Usually when I start a book, it's because I think I know something about a topic, but I know that I'm beginning to realize I don't know quite enough about it. So The Way We Never Were actually started out as a book about women. I was asked to write, back in the early 70s, a book about the history of women. I quickly got bored with it because it was either like what's been done to women through the ages or what a few women have done despite it, and a lot of books were coming out like that. So I said, well, let me see if I can find a place to bring women and men into interaction. And of course, the family finally occurred to me, but that was not a respectable field of study at the time. So I spent 13 years writing a book I now think you could call As Pompous As You Want to Be about the history of family life. And when I looked up from it, I realized that this whole debate was emerging about family, and neither side actually knew the complexity of family history.
Like this fake nostalgia about Ozzie and Harriet 1950s America.
Right, right. So then I wrote a follow-up book to kind of sometimes I think it's not so much to change people's minds as it is to complicate their oversimplified understandings.
Mm. And it sounds like your research changed your mind. Isabel Wilkerson, how about you with the Warmth of Other Suns? Were you setting out to change people's minds about something, or is this just where your research led you?
Well, first of all, I was seeking to understand the phenomenon that had created me, meaning I was a child of this migration and had been raised by people who had participated in it, but they never talked about it. And so that instilled in me this curiosity about what had led them to do what they did. I also wanted to better understand and felt that we could all better understand how the cities came to be and why it was that 6 million people fled the Jim Crow South and went to all points north, Midwest, and West to escape this caste system, and to understand what had motivated them, why they did this, and also how this was so similar to the recognized stories of people who've come from other parts of the world to our country. And I saw these things that they had in common, but these dots had not been connected in that way, and people hadn't really sat down to understand truly what it was like to be these people, and that's what I set out to do.
And I think that's one of the ways that your book has changed people's minds, by having more people think about African Americans and the Great Migration within the country in kind of the same category in certain respects as they think about immigrants from other countries. That's what you were just saying, right?
Exactly. I think to be able to make a connection to something that we already know and is part of our understanding, and to see how it could apply to something that we never would have imagined. I mean, I think that's the that is the beauty of history itself, is to be able to go back and to see in some ways how each of us might have reacted in that situation. You know, history is often thought about with the bold-faced names etched in granite. And I was really trying to understand how individual people, unrecognized people, the silent, invisible people could have an impact in on our country. I mean, this migration ended up changing our country in so many ways, from the social geography of all the cities that they went to the politics of blue states and red states was affected by this outpouring of people who went to the north and were able to vote for the first time in their lives, to music as we know it, from Motown to jazz. So it had this huge impact. And yet the idea of something this big being able to be told through individual people who would be not unlike ourselves, I think allows people to identify with history in a way that is really exciting and is personal and big at the same time, epic in its own way.
Stephanie Kuntz and Isabel Wilkerson in our Books That Change Your Mind series. I don't know if you two have ever met or ever read each other's books. We just had the idea that you two would make an interesting match on the kind of two pieces of family and social history that enlighten readers about history they may have thought too simplistically about from around the same era. I wonder if you see your book, each of you, as fitting into a kind of larger context of revising 20th century history to be more accurate or more inclusive. Stephanie, do you?
Well, I think certainly true. You know, although it is true that you don't try to start out trying to correct people's misapprehensions. You do, like Isabel was talking about, you try to answer your own questions, and in the process, it complicates and expands your thinking about things. And I think the difference between a writer and somebody who's just talking to their neighbor over the fence is that you just feel compelled to share what you found out. And certainly, that's what I did with The Way We Never Were. I didn't think of myself as revising history, but I thought of myself as cutting through a lot of the myths and stereotypes, some of which I had held when I was younger.
Like one? What's one? What's an important one of your own?
Well, for example, I went through successive myths about the place of women. When I was in high school, I thought that, you know, I bought into all of the biological determinism of women and that women are fundamentally different than men and they're more nurturing. And then when I was in college and I read some of the things about how women had been treated through the era, I went through a period of thinking, oh, my God, women have been oppressed by men all over, and that's the most important issue. And then one of the books that changed my mind was a book about witchcraft in early Tudor and Stuart England. And it sort of got me totally beyond this question of men versus women to understand how people sort through social anxieties in a period of change, and especially how they deal with when they have to start behaving in ways that contradict their ideals, the complicated, very sad ways they sometimes come up. Racism is another good example to explain why they're behaving in ways that contradict their ideals.
So
that's what was very useful for me. It gave me more compassion than I had when I started out.
A book about witchcraft changed your mind. Isabel, do you have an example of a book that changed your mind?
Well, I do, but first I'd like to say that I view all of this as an invitation to opening up the table to different ways of viewing how we came to be, you know, who we are and how we are as a country right now. And I think that, you know, when we think about history, the story is incomplete until we have heard from everyone in the room. And that's one of the ways that I think people may use the word revising. But I think of it in terms of opening up the spaces for people who had not been heard before. And so when you do that, you often find that a lot of this material is hidden in plain sight, so that one of the misconceptions that I myself had that was blown away by something that I read in the course of researching this book had to do with assumptions about family formation and the idea that African Americans, when they got to the big cities, had all these children. And I myself, I'm a product of all that we have been taught. And there was a book called A Piece of the Pie by Stanley Lieberson, a sociologist who was at Harvard. And this is a scholarly work, and in it he makes reference to the 1940 census, in which he describes he has a chart about the fertility rates of women arriving to the big cities in 1940. And he compares the women, African-Americans, who had arrived from the South to the North to their Southern and Eastern European counterparts also arriving to the same cities in the North at that same time. And it turned out that the African-American women who come from the South and arrived in the North did not have higher fertility rates than the comparable women coming from Eastern and Southern Europe. Not only were they not the highest rates, they weren't the second highest rates or the third highest rates or the fourth highest rates. They were actually at the bottom of the group of women that he was looking at, the largest number of women coming in to these big cities by that time. And I found that to be really mind-blowing. I also then, once you know the history and you know the story of how these people came, it turned out that they were also making less than these women who were coming in from outside the country. Once they got to the North, they were making less than any of the other groups that had arrived there, and therefore they could not afford any more children. And their birth rates reflect that. So that's the way that by looking at and opening our minds to the world around us and to the record that already may be there, but we just have not seen it or recognized it, helps us to understand who we are as a country and how we came to be.
Are either of you concerned that people read these days less in a way that could open their minds or change their minds? You know, there's all this talk about how we split up into silos on the web and read and share things with our Facebook friends and get shared with things that we already agree with. We're less likely to change our mind. Isabel, are you concerned about that?
I actually, there's a term for it. It's called confirmation bias, meaning that we already have been encoded with assumptions and belief systems that are become so wired in us that we, when we are exposed to new ideas, we often try to either reject them because they don't fit what we have already been trained to believe, or we find a way to recast it so that it fits in with what we have already assumed to be the truth. And so I think that it challenges us to be open, particularly given that new voices are coming into being, new actors are being recognized as part of, you know, the American story. And that has reminded me of these two books that I'm so excited about, The Half Has Never Been Told by Edward Baptist and of course, The Internal Enemy by Alan Taylor, which won the Pulitzer Prize this year. Mm-hmm. These are new ways of looking at what we thought we already knew. And I think that this is, you know, we're on the cusp of a new way of understanding ourselves.
What's a very short take on one of those books and what's so important about it?
Well, those books are helping us to understand, first of all, the origins of the Revolutionary War and the role of enslavement, the institution of slavery in the making of our country with The Internal Enemy. I mean, one of the things that I've been stunned by is it's focusing on the War of 1812, but it also gets to the roots of the role of the state of what was then the colony of Virginia in the founding of our country. You know, we often tend to focus on the northern part of it, the New England role. But all of these things help to, once you recognize and see the blanks filling in, you recognize that all of these things begin to make sense.
I'm going to jump in because we've just got 45 seconds left in the segment. And Stephanie, I want you to get your lick in there. What are you reading currently, if you want to do that similar kind of shout out? And are you also worried about people splitting up through confirmation bias, not reading things that will change their mind?
I'll go directly to that since we don't have much time. I think it's a tremendous danger, and more I try to organize my writing to challenge the people who think that they agree with me, as well as finding places where I may agree with or at least can see the point of somebody who, for example, misses the 1950s and try to explain to them, I understand that. I understand why you would miss a time when the average 30-year-old man could pay for a home on 15 to 18% of his income. But you may be missing why there were other things here that we would not want to go backward for and why we should go forward. And I do think that, that confirmation bias and the siloing is a tremendous problem.
What a wonderful dialogue between Stephanie Coutts and Isabel Wilkerson. I appreciate both of your time so much. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And now another dialogue from our Books That Change Your Mind series. We're doing this in conjunction with the New York City Neighborhood Library Awards. The branch libraries that win will win $20,000 prizes thanks to the Stavros Niarchos and Charles H. Revson Foundations. More information is on our website. Now we're going to talk about books that change your minds about raising different kinds of children and being different kinds of parents, and also the social and political context of different kinds of children, with two writers who shared their own parenting stories while deeply reporting on two aspects of family life we might not want to look at too closely, at least at first. Chris Beam is a professor of creative writing at Columbia and NYU and the author of To the End of June, The Intimate Life of American Foster Care, a New York Times notable book last year, and by Andrew Solomon, the National Book Award-winning author of Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity, about parenting all kinds of exceptional children, children with physical and mental disabilities, children with deafness, or prodigies. So welcome back to WNYC, Andrew Solomon.
What a pleasure to be here.
And Chris Beam.
Thank you.
Did you two set out to upend the reader's idea of what a family could and should be when you set out to write these two books, Andrew?
I did sort of set out to upend that idea. My book deals with how families respond to all these kinds of different children, deaf children, autistic children, children who commit crimes, kids who are transgender. And I wanted to establish the idea that our notion of parental love, which tends to be that your child is somehow an extension of yourself, is really misguided, and that often the experience of having children whose birth or whose diagnosis appears to be a trauma leads to a greater intimacy than you would ever have imagined and establishes an extraordinary closeness.
That's such a fascinating concept that you almost buried there. You almost buried the lead in that answer that could change people's minds about their own parenting, to not think of your children first as extensions of yourself. Could you go a little more into that?
Yes, I think that the word reproduction is a word that kind of confuses people by suggesting that when you have a child, what you're doing is making another one of yourself. And I think that while I was looking at extreme circumstances, that in fact all parenting entails coming to terms with the fact that your child is an independent and different person. And while that difference is often the thing that seems to be the great disruption to love and intimacy, you know, I don't get it. Why are you like that? I wasn't like that. Why are you doing that?
Hello,
that
teenagers.
Often, exactly. Often it's the negotiation of that difference in which the intimacy lies. And so while we tend to think that children who are different are somehow alienating and that our experience of difference is isolating, actually, it's what we all have in common. So while there are only so many families dealing with children with schizophrenia or with Down syndrome or with the other conditions I looked at, what I saw as I continued in this work was that the process of having to think, this child isn't really what I imagined when I imagined having a child, and yet, to my surprise and astonishment, I love this child anyway, and I love this child with his flaws. Mm. That's the universal experience of good parenting.
Not just reproduction, but reproduction and differentiation.
Exactly.
In biology terms. Chris Beam, same question.
You know, I didn't set out to write To the End of June with the intention of changing minds. I really set out with the intention of investigating a system that, from my perspective, was really broken. And yet I think once I came to the end, I did feel like I hope that it changes minds. I hope that it does. You know, when I have a foster daughter, and she's actually my daughter, and Andrew and I were just talking about this outside the studio here. People always ask me, you know, when did you adopt her? Did you adopt her, et cetera? And I think we have this notion in the foster care system, for example, that foster care leads to adoption, and that's sort of the panacea. And with my daughter, I never adopted her because she, for her, that would be giving up hope on her family. And yet she is very much my daughter, and I'm very much her mother. And so I came to this book with a unique perspective, I think, that said I understood that there's a system that is set up to bring kids from fosterhood into adoption, and there's this very set path. And yet there are a lot of us that work around that path, and I wanted to report on the families that do and do it successfully.
So that could really change people's minds about what makes a family.
Mm-hmm.
If your experience is that your daughter is really your daughter, mm-hmm. but you don't want to adopt her because you want to keep her biological family in the mix somehow.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's pretty different than a lot of people's approach to foster or adopted kids.
Right. Well, I mean, I think we have this deep set notion in this country around ownership. I mean, family is really about ownership in a way. And if you don't own your children on paper, and there's some real reasons. I mean, as a queer person, I think I understand this. There are real reasons for needing legal rights to your family and legal rights to your children. I understand that need. But at the same time, it can backfire because we also create unusual and interesting families that are really important, that are about love ties. And if those aren't recognized by the state, they're also not recognized by society. And I think we need to recognize those as well as real and equal families.
There's so much overlap here. I don't even remember which of you put out the concept of thinking of your biological children as if they were adopted. Did that come from one of you?
No, but I think it's a cool idea.
It is a cool idea. I don't know. I think that came from you, Brian.
Oh, maybe it was planted in our office conversation about these two books.
I think I did put in the idea that your children are a voyage of discovery, and that process of discovery often has moments if you're feeling so disaffected and so alienated and so confused and thinking where – I mean, I've not yet met any parent who doesn't occasionally look at his child or her child and think where – did you come from? And I think that fundamental experience of parenting is often one of having started off loving your child because your child is your child, going on to love your child for reasons you've discovered. My child is bright. My child is kind. My child is engaged. And then going on to that process of thinking my child is actually a complete alien, but I love my child anyway.
We are having the latest of our Books That Change Your Minds, Authors, Dialogues here with Chris Beam, who wrote To the End of June, The Intimate Life of American Foster Care, and Andrew Solomon, who wrote Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. You know, I don't even know if you read each other's books. Did mm-hmm. you read each other? Chris, you did?
Yeah, I've read everything Andrew's written.
And likewise, all of Chris's books, absolutely.
So do either of you want to react to the other or ask the other a question? I'm just going to leave this open-ended.
Well, I remember actually having a conversation with you, Andrew, before Far From the Tree came out, and thinking there's no way you can do this, because he was writing about trans kids, and that's something I write about a lot and know a lot about. And he was saying, you know, I'm going to write this book where I'm going to write about trans kids and criminal kids and deaf kids. And I was like, oh, no, the trans community is going to go up. There's no way you can do this because you can't put them all in the same pocket. This is very dangerous. What are you going to do? And then you did it, and it was beautiful. This beautiful idea of it's about horizontal parenting. It's about these kids that are fundamentally different from you, and you took away all the judgment. It's not about good or bad. It's about these kids that are different from you. And I thought, oh my God, he's a genius. He did it. He did it in this really beautiful, empathic way that I hadn't even considered. So, I mean, hats off, really.
Oh, well. And I have to say that Chris's work has actually been a huge influence on mine. An editor who was reading her manuscript got in touch with me and said, I don't think I'm going to be able to buy this book, but I thought it would interest you. It was the book Transparent about bringing up a child who was trans and engaging in the trans community. And I read it and I thought, okay, that has to be one of the chapters of my new book. I have to do it, not in the way that she has, but I have to look at the trans issue. And I'm now working on a new book, which is about our redefinition of family. And I had all kinds of things in there, gay families, changed attitudes towards divorce, open adoption, everything. And then I read To the End of June and I thought, oh, and foster care has to be part of it too, because these exact questions of what constitutes family are going to be central to what I do. So Chris sort of sets me on interesting paths I would not have discovered otherwise, and she does it beautifully, lyrically, and with such deep compassion.
And I saw that you gave a TED Talk, Andrew, based on your book called Love No Matter What. But I'm curious if the stories in Chris's book make you think that sometimes love isn't enough when the state intervenes or should intervene.
I don't think that love makes a family. That's a sort of popular cliche, and I don't think it's true. I think love is part of what makes a family. I think being a family involves a great deal of competence, of being responsible, of recognition of your child. I think loving a child you don't understand and whom you don't attempt to understand is a kind of inadequate kind of love. And I think overall that ultimately, while love should be there from the time a child is born, that the care of a child over time requires acceptance. And I've met many families in which the love seems to be more or less in place and the acceptance isn't, and it's traumatic for the child. So love is a good jumping off point, and certainly I think it's necessary. I don't think you can be a good parent without loving your child.
You're making a distinction between love and acceptance.
Yes. So, for example, I feel like when I was a kid, I had parents who loved me very much. And then when I was an adolescent, I felt that they didn't really want to deal with the fact that I was gay, and I experienced it as a lack of love. And over time, I came to think that what I was dealing with was a lack of acceptance, and that acceptance is a process, and it takes time. Love is there from the start. Acceptance is work. Acceptance should always be the ultimate goal of love, but it is not the same thing.
And I think the other thing to talk about, speaking of sort of aphorisms that we toss about that can be quite dangerous, is this idea that all parents love their children. All parents don't love their children. And I think that that's one of the most terrifying concepts for people to accept, but it's true. And I think it's something that we need to think about and deal with. It's one of the great horrors that no one wants to talk about, but there are parents who don't.
And then
we need to step in. That's when we need to step in. If there's love, I think there's hope. I think Andrew's right. I think that that's a jumping off point. If there's no love, there's not much hope.
I just want to sneak in one phone call, because Deborah in Levittown, I think, wants to thank you, Andrew, for changing her mind. Deborah, you're on WNYC.
Hi. I would like to profoundly thank Mr. Solomon for his book, Far From the Tree. I read many of the chapters that I felt were applicable to me as a mom. I have four sons. My one son is a drug addict and a criminal. And the chapter on the criminal child, where you interviewed Mrs. Klebold, and it just, it spoke to me so profoundly, so deeply, that it wasn't me per se. It wasn't my parenting that made this child a criminal, that made him perform criminal acts that I deplore and that I hate, but I can still love my child.
Deborah, thank you so much.
Thank you for saying that. I think that that's one of the reasons I included that chapter, is that we tend to have got rid of the idea that was for so long in circulation that parents made their children schizophrenic or made their children autistic, but we still live in a world in which people assume that parents make their children criminal. Mm-hmm. And sometimes really terrible parenting can be so traumatic for a child that it pushes a child in that direction. But often, as I did the research, profoundly responsible, deeply engaged, and very loving parents have children who go off this way, the same way that some have children who go off into autism or schizophrenia. And not only is our blaming parents unfair, it's also counterproductive. It's a means of trying to reassure the rest of ourselves that if we're good parents, this can't happen to us.
Deborah,
and the feeling I came away from that chapter with is it can happen to any of us.
Deborah gets our difficult call of the week to make award, and we really appreciate her reaching so deep. All right. 10-second blurbs from each of you on other books that have changed your mind. You got a quickie, Chris? Other books.
Sure. Baldwin's essays, Notes of a Native Son, talking about his family and then connecting it to larger issues.
Oh, Baldwin, second week in a row.
Oh, really? Oh.
Virginia Woolf, Jacob's Room, is the best book on parenting there's ever been, all about the pain and joy of being a mother.
Andrew Solomon and Chris Beam, thank you both very much for coming on and having an amazing dialogue. Chris Beam is the author of To the End of June, The Intimate Life of American Foster Care. And Andrew Solomon wrote Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. Coming up next, the poet laureate of basketball, Walt Clyde Frazier, with City Law Executive Director Steve Zeitlin.
Intoxicating, mesmerizing, very apropos with the hat that he's had, and chanting and enthralling the crowd, erupting his teammates, Henson posting and toasting. Melo started out dishing, now swishing from behind the arc. Dancing and prancing is Melo along the baseline.
Dishing and swishing and dancing and prancing. And if you watch the Knicks on TV, you know the poetry of Walt Clyde Frazier, who calls games for the Knicks. Of course, once a Knicks on the court legend as well. And here with me to talk about the poetry of basketball is that basketball legend, Walt Frazier, and Steve Zeitlin, the executive director of City Lore. Steve, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks so much.
Walt Frazier, I'm getting goosebumps knowing you're there. Thanks for coming on.
Hi, my pleasure. Thank you.
Where did this start for you, Walt? Did you, even as a player, make up rhymes on the court, off the court?
No, originally I started on radio, and radio, there are nuances. The color guy on radio doesn't say anything. So the only time you really talk is when there's a foul or when there's a turnover. So I was kind of bored, and the guy that I was working with was accustomed to working by himself, so I never really got a chance to say anything. So I figured out, well, you know, I was come up with these rhymes because when I tried to explain something, he would always say, "Excuse me, Walt," he'd just run right over me. So if the Knicks were doing something, passing the ball and moving around, I go, "They're dishing and swishing." You know, I get in and out before he could say anything. And it was sort of a necessity at the time in order to get in a few words.
And it obviously became a successful thing for you. And so do you make them up as you go along? Do you sit at a computer and do homework and try to think of another six, or how does that work?
Yeah, well, the other thing was when I first started, I used to do a pregame, halftime, postgame show with Greg Gumbel. Greg was at the Garden. So we would articulate about something, maybe 2 or 3 minutes, but I never knew what he would ask me. So I was pretty intimidated that whatever he might ask me, I wouldn't be able to shut up. I'd keep going on and on. And I was like, man, I've got to improve my vocabulary. Because normally I'm a guy, I like to joke around and tease and be funny. But I was very tense that, you know, I wasn't myself. So what I used to do, I used to get the Sunday Times, the arts and leisure section, when they critique the plays, riveting, mesmerizing, provocative, profound, dazzling, all these different words. I like the way they sound. So I have books and books of words and phrases that I come up with. And then once I learn the words, it's easy to start rhyming them, you know, dishing and swishing. The other thing was being in New York, I had been away from the game for a while, and I was saying passing, and they were saying dishing. This is the average fan. Yeah. And I'm saying fast break, and they're saying transition and versatility. And I'm going, wait a minute. If I'm going to do this, this is the way I should sound. If this is my profession, these people should sound better than me. So the New York fans actually put a lot of pressure on me as well to try to improve my delivery and being a broadcaster.
I have to tell you, not every broadcaster comes to it with nearly as much consciousness as that. So that is a great story for a radio guy to hear. Steve Zeitlin from City Lore, where do you come into this with Clyde Frazier?
Well, City Lore, we're about the living cultural heritage of New York City, and Walt is part of that. And we're about the art of everyday life. And somehow it seems to me that the poet laureate of basketball, the idea that there is so much artistry in basketball in the person of Walt Frazier, both as a player, where in his book he talks about how every player dribbles in a different rhythm. I love that. I love that idea. And then on the radio, of course, he's the poet laureate of basketball.
Do you think there's something especially rhythmic about calling a basketball game as opposed to other sports like baseball, which is much slower?
Oh, yeah, definitely. When a team goes on a run, you know, a basketball, you can go on a 12-0 run in a couple of minutes. So that's when I like the dishing and swishing. They're starting to percolate. You know, they're moving and grooving. They're shaking and baking. So you can definitely get into that groove once they start to go on a run.
Do you see it as jazz, almost like improvisation? the way they're improvising on the court as a kind of jazz in some fashion? I know you listen to a lot of jazz.
Yeah, yeah, the highs and lows. It's more upbeat jazz, you know, not the monk. So it's a Ramsey Lewis type of jazz to me. It's light rock.
Though there are times to slow it down and get mellow, so you'll be ready for that. Not that mellow, just M-E-L-L-O-W, so that you get...
Yeah, that mellow, the mellow drummer.
That's right. So you're ready for the next explosion. Bob in Rego Park, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hey, Brian, how you doing? Walt, I'd just like to say, first of all, I'd say you were poetry in motion. The way you defended, the way you used to move your legs, the rhythm, the way you used to steal. In my opinion, you were one of the greatest guards that ever played the game. I'd like to ask you a quick question about the Knicks itself. The Knicks, unlike your team with Willis Reed, Dave DeBuscia, were incredibly intelligent. Today's players, including the Knicks, they don't defend, they don't box out, they don't play the passing lanes. They could never, ever win. I'd just like to know, what could you do to talk to Phil Jackson and tell these guys to play the way you used to play and Phil Jackson used
all
to
right.
play?
Phil is very cognizant of that. If you notice, he's going back to the old school fundamentals. The Knicks had their training camp at West Point because I said, Phil, why are you at West Point? He's saying, Clyde, I want to instill discipline in these guys, camaraderie, a sense of history, going back to the little things that make a team a champion. So when I talk to Phil Jackson, I see a lot of my former coach in him, Red Holtzman, where Red was a player's coach. The players could have an impact on what was going on. And I think Phil is very receptive to that and getting back to the basic fundamentals of the game that you alluded to that these players don't really play with. Like the pick and roll play is the oldest play in the game. It's still one of the most effective. Whatever happened to the hook shot? Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, the leading scorer in the history of the game, over 38,000 points utilized in the hook shot. But these guys, this old school, they won't use a hook shot because it's too old. It looks old. So a lot of the players today are caught up on style over substance. You know, the game today is primarily dunks and threes. You rarely see the mid-range jumper, guys shooting off the dribble. And a lot of that is because of ESPN. You won't get on ESPN making a good defensive play unless it's a game-winning block shot. So people like the glamour and the provocativeness of the offense.
Hank in Fort Lee, you're on WNYC with Walt Frazier and Steve Zeitlin. Hi.
Hi, Walt. I remember leaving the Garden after every game and seeing your roles with the slope back and it's with the license plate Clyde. And I was always in awe of you and the car. And I wore your sneakers back then, the Clydes. And then when I was old enough to drive, I was driving down 2nd Avenue once, and I saw the car double parked. And I drove past it, and I pulled over, and I waited. And out you came from a dry cleaner's, and you had an armful of dry cleaning, and you got in the car. Okay. And I approached you, and you were so gracious, and you gave me an autograph, which I still have. To this day, I've showed my children. They can't even believe that I met you then. But
and Hank, I'm going to leave it there so I can get some other folks on. I'm sure Walt appreciates the story and the appreciation. And let me go.
I'd just like to say to Hank that my most profound memory, I've been working the Knick games, I can't believe, for 25 years. Mm. And when I go to the Garden, I'm oblivious of my number hanging in the rafters up there with the other Knick greats. My most profound moment, every night I leave Madison Square Garden, I have a flashback to my career, in the twilight of my career, when the Knicks weren't winning, I was no longer the superstar of the team. There were always a group of kids waiting for me, 4 or 5 kids. Hey, Clyde, can I carry your bag? Hey, Clyde, you're still the greatest. Hey, Clyde, can you do this? So I never forgot that, and that's why I'm so humble to the New York fans. So whenever you come to a Knick game, there's one autograph you're going to always be guaranteed to get.
He doesn't,
that's mine.
He doesn't bumble because he's so humble. Gary in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Gary.
Hi there. How you doing? Yeah, I'm not surprised at your success as a broadcaster, Clyde, because you know how to get to the crux of success. I say that because I read a book that you wrote when I was a kid. It said you can't go anywhere without your hips. As as a defensive strategy, and I always use that, and I always play good defense. So when, because you were able to get to the puck back then, I'm not surprised that you can find success in broadcasting.
Oh, thank you very much. Defense was my favorite part of the game. What happened when I was in college, I was ineligible to play 1 year because of poor grades. So in practice, every day the coach made me play defense. So, you know, I never blamed the coach. I've always been a pragmatic person. So I said, well, if I have to play defense, I'm going to be the best defensive player around. So I mastered the technique of dribbling, the cadence that guys dribble with, how they dribble, where they pass the ball. So that was the beginning of my love for defense.
Hey, I want to ask you a political question, only because we talk a lot of politics on this show. And when Earl Monroe was here recently, he had a memory of when he was
with... Earl Monroe, who's he?
Yeah, some guy. And a memory of his days with the Knicks, and it was the 70s, and there was a lot of politics in the air, and that he and teammates used to talk about what was going on. Do you have a memory like that, and do you think players do it today?
I doubt if players are into politics today because of all the social media, other things that are happening. But we had a veteran team. We had Dick Barnett, Willis Reed, obviously Senator Bradley, the Busher, Jerry Lucas, all these very astute guys who were always up on politics or whatever event that was going on. And remember, we only had three networks. One time I roomed with Bill Bradley, and it was 5 o'clock. He sits in front of the TV switching from news to news. I was like, this guy's crazy. So he's sitting there just sitting, flipping the TV back and forth. So, you know, that was what we did. We even talked basketball. You think today the guys talk basketball?
They don't talk basketball on a basketball team?
They all have computers. They've all got all these different other distractions. It's like we used to have roommates. These guys don't have roommates. They all have their own suite. We always had roommates. I remember Phil Jackson and I were roommates for a couple of years. We came to the team together. So you go out with your roommate, you talk basketball, you go out to dinner, you go out to movies. So that's where the camaraderie developed with those players from the past, because you had to. When you were in Cleveland in February, what is there to do?
but
basketball.
Speaking
of, there's 10 inches of snow on the ground or something. Where are you going to go? What are you going to do?
Now you go on Facebook. Steve Zeitlin from City Lore. Thank you very much. Walt Clyde Frazier, we're blessed to have you on the show for a few minutes. Keep it up. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Thanks to all of you for listening. Hope you enjoyed some best of segments today. Have a great weekend. We'll be back live on Monday.